This hour on Inside Islam.
Islam, like all pre-modern religions, is undemocratic in spirit. No less than the others, however, it has the potential to evolve in a democratic direction. It is undemocratic in spirit in the sense that democracy involves political participation, and this is alien to religious traditions. If anything, they emphasize God's sovereignty and implies a power for the priests and a disdain for what the masses think.
That's Daniel Pipes, political commentator and director of the Middle East Forum, speaking at a panel on Islam and democracy in Sydney, Australia, in 2008. That was 3 years before last year's popular uprisings that began in Tunisia and spread through the Middle East, toppling one dictator after another. Did Mr. Pipes have a point, or is it all too soon to tell? Welcome to Inside Islam on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, from Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Islam and Democracy, the Unfinished Revolution. Were you surprised by the Arab uprisings? What are the images that could lead you to believe that Islam and democracy are incompatible? How will the Arab uprisings ultimately impact the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Our democracy is premised on the separation of church and state. Can you envision a different kind of democracy emerging in the Middle East? To join the conversation, call 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Send an email to hereonearth@wpr.org. To follow us on Facebook or Twitter, go to Here on Earth Show. Reza Aslan is an Iranian-born scholar of religions, associate professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and founder of AslanMedia.com. He's the author of several books, including No God But God, The Origins and Evolution of Islam. He's also a veteran guest on our Inside Islam series, and we're happy to welcome him back for the sixth round. Reza Aslan joins us by phone from Pittsburgh. Hi, Reza. Welcome back.
Hi, it's great to be back on the show, Gene. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mark Lynch, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University, where he is the Director of the Institute for Middle East Studies and the Project on Middle East Political Science. He's also a Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security and edits the Middle East Channel for foreignpolicy.com and is the author of the brand new book, The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. Mark Lynch, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Gene.
So, neither of you was surprised by the Arab uprisings. Reza, you first.
Yeah, I often talk about this as the biggest joke about the Arab uprisings, is that it was a surprise. It was a surprise if you haven't been paying any attention for the last decade. But, I mean, anyone who has been, including certainly Mark, who's noticed the massive youth bulge coupled with massive unemployment, high rates of literacy and education, access to new ideas, new sources of knowledge, the rising tide of globalization that has completely swept through this part of the world, and not to mention, obviously, the internet and social media. Those of us who have been paying attention to this region have just been sitting around wondering when it was going to happen. I'm surprised it took until 2011.
And Mark, you've been watching very closely, as Reza just mentioned, and you go all the way back to the 1950s when there were uprisings, and I don't know if you'd call them revolutions, but certainly stirrings along those lines.
Yeah, I think there's this great myth out there that the Arab public was passive, that they were simply willing to accept dictatorship. And that's really never been the case. If you go back to the 1950s, you had, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people coming out into the streets and protesting. You had governments overthrown. There was a lot of political activism back then. It is true that if you get into, like, the 1970s, 1980s, these authoritarian regimes really did clamp down, and they managed to crush a lot of civil society and popular movement. But if you look back, ever since, say, just to pick a date, let's say 2000, it's been pretty much constant turmoil in the Middle East with all kinds of activism, protest movements, attempts to challenge authoritarian governments. So I would almost see the Arab uprisings that broke out last year not so much as something which came out of nowhere, but more that this was like a steadily rising tide that finally overflowed the dam.
But many people think that it wasn't really true democracy that fueled these uprisings, but a desire for improved economic conditions, not a desire for democratic freedoms. Reza, you have your pulse on the Arab youth. What would you say to that?
Well, frankly, the people who do say that often are making another point altogether, which is that this is a region of the world in which democracy just simply cannot work, period. And so what looks like democracy and sounds like democracy is actually young people blowing off steam or complaining about the socioeconomic conditions of the region. Frankly, every single poll, every survey that has ever been conducted on this issue has proven repeatedly that this is not the case. In fact, just not 6 months ago, a German advertising company named Asta Marstetter did a poll of 9 Arab countries in which they discovered that not only did in all 9 countries the population say that democracy is their single greatest aspiration, but they explicitly ranked democracy, the achievement of democracy, as a higher aspiration, as a higher goal than access to greater to education, higher wages, civil infrastructure, all of these things that so many pundits in the United States continually say that is really behind what's going on. Look, obviously there is a socioeconomic factor that led to these uprisings in the first place. But I think if anyone tells you that this is not about the most obvious, the most heartfelt desire to simply have a say, to have a voice in the decisions that rule these people's lives, I think is being disingenuous.
Mark, what do we mean by democracy in this context? I mean, I think Americans have a certain set of assumptions when they talk about democracy. Is it really the same thing in the Middle East?
Well, that's a really good question, but I wanted to just add one thing to what Reza said, and I agree with everything he said. But one thing which was interesting is right after the Tunisian revolution, or actually during the Tunisian revolution, there was a great line which was being circulated by a leading Tunisian dissident that said that the revolution was not so that Tunisians could have bread, it was so that they could deserve to have bread. And I thought that captured something really powerful, the notion that, yes, there's all kinds of economic complaints, massive unemployment, corruption, all of these things that I think were behind the protests and the anger, but they weren't at its root the cause, that there was this exclusion and this feeling of being left out and cut out of any kind of meaningful participation, which really did, I think, get to the root of what people were protesting about. And then, you know, so the answer to your question then is that when they talk about democracy, they might not mean that what they want is to imitate American political institutions, but I think there is a very powerful sense of wanting forms of accountability, of transparency, and of meaningful participation. So much of the way Arab politics has been built over the last decades has been about protecting the status of this small and ever-shrinking band of elites. And so they've been doing great. You know, when you hear about Egypt having a 7 or 8% annual GDP growth, it's like all going to this small ruling elite over the last 10 years. while everyone else is surrounded by a crumbling infrastructure and no jobs, and everything's getting worse and worse. And so I don't think there's a distinction necessarily between there being all these economic problems, but also the revolutions really at their root being about this desire to participate, to impose some kind of accountability on the leadership.
Where does this desire for democracy come from? Certainly, there is a resistance to imitate Western institutions, and for very good reasons, because we've always been on the side of the dictators, the very people that these young people managed to overthrow.
But I would point back to what Reza said, that I think that Arabs have always been able to distinguish between democracy as something which is good and America. So there's no reason why people who are pro-democracy would expect them to be supportive of American foreign policy. That was always a mistake that people always make in the United States, that if they're pro-democratic, they must be pro-American. But not at all. What they see, as you said, is that the United States was supporting the dictators. Their view of democracy was often about trying to have a foreign policy which better responded to their aspirations. But if you go back and you look at public opinion polling, going back more than a decade, almost all of the polls show that upwards of 90% of Arab publics say that democracy is the best form of government. And it's not ambiguous at all. This has been an extremely powerful consensus across Arab society, including most Islamist movements, for well over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on a larger point there, too, Gene, is that we have to stop talking about democracy as though it can exist outside of a context. In some ways, there's really no such thing as democracy. I like to think of democracy as just this sort of this delicious soup, full of these various ingredients that we toss in, and it's the ingredients that matter: the separation of powers, government accountability, the rule of law, constitutionalism, ethnic and religious pluralism, human rights. It is these things that are important, and put together in a governmental system, they add up to a democratic system. But when we have to get away from this idea that there is this single thing called democracy, and that when an Arab or an African or an Asian talks about it, what they are talking about is what an American thinks of when they think of the word democracy.
Mm. When you think about what was going on in Tunisia first, and then in Tahrir Square, and the, I think the word, the adjective dizzying is what you used, Mark, to describe it. When it seemed like anything was possible, and what really emerged was the power, the force of nonviolence. One thought of it as a force more powerful, almost in Gandhian terms. And now, and it's not that much later after all, I mean, where are we? Just a little bit over a year since these uprisings started. Where are we now, and how has it turned so dark?
Well, I just did a post on this on foreign policy on Monday, that it was actually this week, 1 year ago, when things really turned dark. Because if you go back to Tunisia and Egypt, it was happening, as you said, in this very compressed time. And when Mubarak fell and Ben Ali had already fallen, there was this dizzying sense of anything being possible. And the thing which was so amazing about it was how it spread around the entire region all at once. And so you could see the same slogans being chanted simultaneously in Yemen, Morocco, kind of Jordan, Egypt. Across the entire region, you have protesters who are demonstrating peacefully, chanting the same slogans, and they clearly saw themselves as part of this unstoppable wave. And then, exactly 1 year ago, you get this, all these things coming together at the same time. You have Saudi Arabia intervenes in Bahrain and helps to crush the uprising there. You have the NATO intervention in Libya. You have the rise of the Syrian protest movement, which is immediately met with pretty brutal force by the Assad regime, and a couple of other things all happening at the exact same time. And since then, there definitely is a sense that things kind of slowed down. The agenda fragmented, things got more violent, bloodier, and the sense of that overwhelming, unstoppable force had been blunted. But I actually think that in the longer term, that this is only another phase in the unfolding of a long-term process. I just don't think there's any going back to the way that Arab politics was before. This is a generational change, and it's going to take time. It's going to be a long, hard struggle. But I don't think that we should be, you know, that we should be giving up now or become despondent any more than, you know, we might have gotten a little carried away back in February, but we shouldn't be too despondent right now. I mean, I think these changes are inevitable.
We're talking this hour about Islam and democracy and the unfinished revolutions of the Middle East. With me today, Reza Aslan, internationally acclaimed writer and religious scholar, contributing editor at The Daily Beast, Middle East analyst for CBS News, associate professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. Mark Lynch, associate professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, the author of The Arab Uprising. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to the very last Inside Islam Dialogues and Debates show on Here on Earth. This hour, we're talking about the Arab uprisings and what they can tell us about the link between democracy and Islam. We're at 1-877-GLOBE. 1-877-456-2307. Are you despondent at the prospect of real democracy emerging in the Middle East? Were you surprised by the Arab uprisings? What are the images of Islam that could lead you to believe that Islam and democracy are incompatible? Our democracy is premised on the separation of church and state. Can you imagine or envision a kind of democracy emerging in the Middle East that would be different? How do you think the Arab revolutions will ultimately impact the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can also reach us on Facebook or Twitter. Just go to Here on Earth Show, one word. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Inside Islam, Dialogues and Debates on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders from Wisconsin Public Radio. At the height of the Cairo protests, Egyptian law scholar and diplomat Mohamed El-Baradei spoke frequently to the Western media on the subject of Muslim democracy. In one interview, he was asked about the Muslim Brotherhood and how it compares to the Ayatollahs who took power after Iran's 1979 revolution.
This is a myth that was sold by the Mubarak regime, that it's either us, the ruthless dictators, or Al-Qaeda type. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood has nothing to do with the Iranian model, has nothing to do with extremism. The Muslim Brotherhood is a religiously conservative group. They are a minority in Egypt, but they have a lot of credibility because all the other liberal parties have been smothered for 30 years. They are in favor of a civil state that every Egyptian have the same rights. State in no way will be a state based on religion. And I have been reaching out to them that we need to include them. They are part of the Egyptian society as much as the Marxist party here.
Mark Lynch and Reza Aslan are with us this hour, two leading experts on the Middle East situation. Let's go to you first, Mark, because you mentioned on that same post about the change, the downward turning point that took place just a year ago this week. And one of those changes had to do with the Egyptian referendum, the constitutional referendum, that led to, in part, to the outcome of the elections. And the Muslim Brotherhood certainly gained ascendancy, but it's not clear exactly what they represent or whether that's a good or bad thing for democracy. Can you help clear that up?
Well, there's a couple of different issues here. One is that generally speaking, I think it's a good thing when you have Islamist movements that are participating in electoral politics. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in other Arab countries has always participated in elections when they've had the opportunity to do so. So that's nothing new. And that's part of the reason why they did it so well, is they had a well-oiled campaign machine. They're very experienced politicians. But you also have the Salafi movement, a much, I guess you would say, a more extreme version of an Islamist movement, which in the past had always rejected democracy, that it was substituting the will of man over the will of God, and they viewed it as heresy. And yet there they were, going out there enthusiastically running candidates in elections and winning, you know, something like 20% of the seats in the parliament. And I think that's unambiguously a good thing. You don't want these guys on the outside, you know, going in the direction of violence and extremism and alienation. You want them in the system. And so that's the good side. I think the downside is that nobody, because there's no rules of the game yet in a place like Egypt, nobody really knows exactly what kind of system is going to emerge and what the priorities are going to be. So the Brotherhood has been very careful to try and focus their efforts on the economy, on corruption, on issues that have a broad appeal. And some of the Salafi members of parliament have concentrated on things like, you know, trying to have prayers during the parliamentary session and things like that. And so I think that, you know, when liberals or secularists or just ordinary people look at this, there's a lot of fear out there. Christians are afraid, secularists are afraid that they're going to end up with a constitution and a political system that are dominated by these religious conservatives. And I think that we're not going to see those fears recede until there's a constitution and a track record that can really make clear what the rules of the game are, what's possible, what's not possible. And I think there's going to be a lot, there's still going to be a long learning process, both for the Islamists and for the non-Islamists in a place like Egypt.
You know, I'm thinking about those images that were beamed to us first from Tahrir Square. And you had the extraordinary courage on the part of the young people. We heard some of the chanting, and that sort of triggered that memory. At the same time, we saw whenever there was the call to prayer, everybody got down on their hands and knees and prayed. Reza, I'm going to ask you this question. I think in the American sensibility, there is something about that posture of submission that suggests the incompatibility with democracy.
Yeah, that's a funny thing for Americans to think, considering that the current leading GOP contender thinks the world is 6,000 years old, wants to outlaw homosexuality, take away birth control, and force women who've been raped to have their babies. And that's okay. Rick Santorum, when he was a senator, went on the floor of Congress with some 50, 60 of his fellow senators. This was during the Terry Schiavo case, if you recall, and led a prayer group that publicly called on the wrath of God to come down on the federal judges with whom he disagreed. But that's okay. See, there's this myth that we have that this country is founded on the separation of church and state that you've said a couple of times. No, we are not founded on the separation of church and state. We do have an anti-establishment clause in the Constitution that prohibits Americans from being forced to support any one church over another. But in a country in which, according to Washington Post and Newsweek, 7 out of 10 Americans define themselves as Christian, it is only natural that our laws, our values, our norms, even our very customs are deeply steeped in Christian symbolism. And frankly, it's sort of inconceivable to think that, you know, a politician in this country can run for high office without being able to speak the language of religion, because after all, the language of religion holds the most currency for the masses. Why are we so surprised when that is also true in some other part of the world? Why are we so comfortable in having our leaders speak about the most mundane social and economic issues in the most profoundly Christian language? But when we hear a member of the Muslim Brotherhood talk about social justice or economic rights and do so in the language of Islam, we immediately tag him as a theocrat and run the other way. You know, this kind of misperception, I think, Which, by the way, goes both ways in many ways. I mean, there's also an incredible amount of misperception in the Middle East about the role of religion in society in the United States. I think is really at the heart of why you hear people constantly express doubts about democracy being able to flourish in Muslim-majority states, as though Islam has something to do with it. Even the very topic, you know, Islam and democracy is sort of silly. I mean, obviously, if you live in a culture that's some 95-96% Muslim, as Egypt is, and you have a democratic system where the majority values and norms are going to obviously have an influence on the state and society, then certainly, you know, Islam is going to have an influential role in the government, in the way that Christianity has an enormously influential role in the American government. But so what? I mean, this is just sort of part of the democratic process.
We have Rob joining us from Norwalk next, and open lines for anybody else who'd like to join in. The topic this hour is Islam and Democracy and the Unfinished Revolutions of the Middle East. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07. Hi, Rob. Thanks for the call.
Hello. I'm speaking as a Buddhist who lived for 20 years in Southeast Asia. The history of Buddhism in countries like Thailand, where I live, is not very democratic, largely because Buddhist history has been within social structures that are feudal and not all that different than the Catholic Church as it still exists today.
Mm-hmm.
So my main point is, in the countries that I'm familiar with, such as Thailand, Malaysia, India, it's a long, difficult process. It's also difficult in rural Wisconsin. There are local Christians who argue that we should not be where we are, that is my Buddhist center, because we're Buddhist. Fortunately, there are more people who are tolerant than that small but vocal minority.
I think your point is very well taken, Rob. I'm really glad you joined the conversation, because, first of all, it goes right back to the comment we heard from Daniel Pipes at the start of the program that that religion in itself, and this is not, we're not just talking about Islam here, but as you pointed out, Buddhism and Catholicism, they're not democratic. They have a priestly caste. Authority rests in the priestly caste. But if you live in a democracy like the United States, you grow up with a developing critical intelligence, hopefully. And also this idea of irreverence for authority. I mean, that's sort of in our culture. And you begin to ask questions and you begin to form your own judgments. And then an interesting dialogue starts to emerge. There's something called the American Catholic Church, which is disdained by the Vatican because it is so independent-minded. So I think what you're pointing out here is that, yes, perhaps we can agree that Islam may be undemocratic in spirit, like other religions, but that it does have the potential to evolve in a democratic direction. And probably that direction would resist secularism, capitalism, and materialism. Mark, how would you weigh in on that?
I mean, I think that these are generic problems, as you said, and you could look back to the history of European movements. You can look back at all of these religions, and you know, it's just, I was really struck by something Reza said just a little while ago, that basically, you know, if you've got a majority of a population that really takes a faith seriously, of course that's going to be reflected in a democratic system. But then the question is, you know, do you have the kind of political institutions that can reconcile a really discordant views? And that's something which is the genius of democracy, but not always realized. And, you know, you think about something like, if you really truly believe that abortion is murder, then how can that be reconciled with tolerating the view of another? And that's one of, that has historically been one of the hardest things for any political system to deal with, is that kind of not just a clash of interest, but that fundamental clash of truly deeply held beliefs. And kind of as I was saying before, the problem in a place like Egypt or Tunisia is that they don't have those rules in place yet.
Right. And I think that the important thing that Mark brings up there, you know, that we can't forget is that two things. One, that democracy is not an event. It's a process. I mean, you know, we've been working at it for 250 years in this country. We're still trying to figure out the role of, you know, religion in society and all those things. And that the important thing here is that as long as those elements that I was talking about, those ingredients that I was talking about that make up a democracy remain inviolable, then, you know, there are protections put in place for those who do not share the values of the majority. But in a much more larger and philosophical point, we have to understand that there is no such thing as religion in a vacuum. There is no such thing as religion without culture. Religion is defined by culture, not the other way around. It is culture that affects religion, not religion that affects culture. Every religious scholar, you know, will tell you that. So this notion that, you know, by itself, Islam is or is not compatible with democracy is a nonsensical question. The question that we should be asking is, how will democracy in Egypt affect Islam? That is a question that we can actually, you know, pinpoint and put our finger to.
Okay, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think it will in the same way that it has in Indonesia, in Turkey, in Senegal, in Pakistan, in Bangladesh, in India. You know, there, you know, a third of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims live in democratic states. The kind of Islam that we see, for instance, arising out of the American milieu is I mean, barely like the kind of Islam that one sees in, say, the Sudan or even in a place like Egypt. So, you know, what you're going to get is a distinctly Arab, a distinctly Egyptian, and a rapidly, I think, modernizing view of Islam insofar as it needs to change to accommodate the immediate needs of the people. You know, when the people are in a situation of a great political oppression, then Islam becomes a tool of political opposition. When people are in a situation of a robust, thriving democracy, then Islam will become a tool of that democracy.
By the way, we're going to have a conference on Islam and democracy that will be hosted here on the campus of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And you can find information about it. It'll be coming up on the 13th and 14th of April. Just go to insideislam.wisc.edu to find out more about that. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Inside Islam, the last program on Here on Earth, the last program in this series on Here on Earth. We are now in our fourth year, and all of our programs are on, you can find them on our archive. We're talking this hour with Reza Aslan and Mark Lynch. I'm Jean Faraca. We have an open line if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-877-GLOBE-07. 1-877-456-2307. باهي طلعتوهم توا خيرهم كانوا غادي واتين بتهربوا حي عليكم من بنغازي يا شحاحة يا ويلكم من غضب الفلاحة متملح بين ننزلها على روسكم زل ملاحة غير تزلزل الدنيا ويلقوكم فول ساحة وقتها تراقول برا. When you ask Muslims about those qualities that we associate with democracy, self-determination, the rule of law, free speech, free press, we see that majorities of Muslims want these freedoms, want a more open and accountable political system. But many do not believe that they have to choose between Islam and democracy. And so for many, they do not want a Western secular democracy, but want to see a form of government that is in fact informed by religious values and principles. That's John Esposito, professor of international affairs and Islamic studies at Georgetown. Speaking in 2009 on the Democratic Desires of Muslim Citizens, we're talking this hour about Islam and democracy and the unfinished revolutions of the Middle East. My guests are Reza Aslan and Mark Lynch. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07, and we have Colin joining us from Madison. Hi, Colin.
Hi. Hi, Mark. Hi, Reza. How are you?
Good, hey. Colin. Thanks.
So, Mark, you talked about democracy as representing various things, so freedom of expression and accountability and separation of powers. And I'm wondering if you both could comment on sort of this larger concept of justice and democracy and what that encompasses as being under this larger idea of justice and the role of ijtihad in all of this. Now, obviously not all Arabs are Muslim, so we have to talk about minority groups as well, but this is an important concept in Islam, and I'm wondering if you both could comment on how that has played a role in this idea that justice is really, I think, the larger motivation here, and democracy is one part of that. So.
First, we need a definition of ijtihad. Reza?
Ijtihad refers to independent juristic reasoning. Really what it means is that if you are of a certain caliber in your education in one of the accepted schools of laws, you're able to make declarative judgments about some aspect of Islamic law without referencing necessarily the Quran or the traditional sources. You can just simply use your own reasoning. In the modern world, ijtihad has come to be thought of as something that all Muslims can do. It was never that. That's a very modern construction of it, but that all Muslims can just, you know, independently and on their own make interpretations about Islam, and so this idea that, you know, the part of the reformation of Islam involves going back to that concept of individual interpretation is what is meant by this idea of ijtihad.
In some interpretations, ijtihad stopped sometime in the Middle Ages, but you're saying that in modern understandings, it continues. It's sort of like when Christians sit down and decide whether or not homosexuality is moral or not.
Yeah, and ijtihad never stopped. I mean, it's a scholarly fallacy to say that there was this moment in which suddenly the gates of ijtihad were closed. No, I mean, this is part of the process of being of any faith, is the sense of individualism, the opportunity to interpret it yourself, whether you officially call it ijtihad or not.
Uh-huh. So, and how does this relate to the overriding question? How does democracy, and presuming that ijtihad is a kind of a democratic process, how does it relate to justice? And I can't help but think about one of the things that, you know, these dictators represented was injustice. Mark?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I guess what I would say is that, you know, when we think about democracy, usually the first thing that comes to mind is the election itself, the act of voting. But if you break it down, you know, what is democracy for? What is it supposed to achieve? As some of those things are things I was mentioning before, things like transparency and accountability and a number of things which basically mean that rulers rule by the consent of the governed. And voting is just a means. It's just an instrument to make that happen. So when you say that it's not really about democracy, it's really about justice, I don't necessarily see the contradiction there. In other words, mm-hmm. I see democracy as a set of instruments and tools by which people are able to force their rulers to be accountable and to give them justice, to give them a voice in how they themselves are ruled. And I don't think that's unique to Islam. I think that's something which is built into the very nature of what democracy is supposed to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Reza?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, democracy, in a sense, is a platform. It's a tactic, and you know, this notion of social justice, of being in a situation where your dignity is preserved. I mean, this has been an argument going on in the Middle East for many years. Al-Qaeda, jihadism itself as a movement, is based wholly on this conception that there are these despicable Western-backed dictators in the Middle East oppressing and murdering their own people, and that the cause of justice requires people to take up arms and to bring them down through violent revolution. The thing is that it didn't work. Violent revolution didn't work, and nonviolent democracy seems to be working. That's the only difference between these two things, is that they are tactics, they're strategies for bringing about the ultimate goal of social justice.
Dan is next, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, democracy is important, but the Bill of Rights is even more important. And that's where I see the big difference between these fundamentalist Arab states, Muslim states, and the United States, and comparing the two is kind of ridiculous. The United States doesn't even allow prayer in school anymore. You can be a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu, an atheist, and you can be extremely successful in this country. I've got relatives who had to leave Egypt because they were Coptic Christians, and they had no future there. They were afraid of their life, and they had to move here. Try to open a Christian church in Iran. Try to open a Christian church in Saudi Arabia. It's impossible. In Iran, they're about to kill a guy just because he converted to Christianity. So until they have a Bill of Rights in that country and that people's individual differences are respected, democracy is a pipe dream for them.
Mark?
Well, I mean, in a sense, that's what I was saying, is that, you know, the Bill of Rights part is all about guaranteeing those fundamental freedoms and individual rights and all of those things. And you're absolutely right that in countries that are in transition, whether it's Egypt or Tunisia or non-Arab, non-Muslim countries, if you don't have those guarantees, then there is always a real risk of being left to the tyranny of the majority. And I think that as they're drafting these constitutions, that's where a lot of the debate is going to really center around. And I think that's going to focus in part on things that, like the abortion debate in the United States, that get to those fundamental values, such as, do people have the right to leave their religion? This is something which is, you know, gets to the root of how many Muslims understand their religion. And if it comes up in the drafting of the Constitution, it's going to be extremely contentious. And again, I think we're heading into some really interesting debates, constitutional debates, in places like Egypt and Tunisia. But I would say that there's an enormous difference between what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia and what you see in Iran or Saudi Arabia, which are both, I would say, fairly extreme forms of Islamic despotism, where you have the really harsh enforcement and control over public life and over morality by enforced by the state. You don't have anything like that in Egypt and Tunisia or in many of the other transitional Arab countries. And so I don't think it's right to generalize from Saudi Arabia and Iran, which I think are extreme examples of what I would say is an unhealthily exaggerated role of religion, to these countries that are actually trying to design some kind of balance, some of which will get it right and some of which probably won't.
Mm. Thanks, Dan. Let's go to William next in Eau Claire.
Hi, Gene. I just wanted to first say that I'll be really sorry to see you go. I always love listening to your show.
Oh, thank you.
And my comment is that I think Islam is sort of a red herring in this debate. I think that people are really worried because of the memory of something like the French Revolution. And that's really what I've been thinking about the whole time that this Arab Spring has been going on.
Huh.
I think the reason people are going out into the streets is because they're poor and they want jobs, most of all. And democracy doesn't really guarantee that. You know, changing the government won't give you jobs all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the worry is that it will be something like the French Revolution, where no matter what government you put in place, there's always going to be dissatisfaction, and it'll just be a feedback loop, circling around on itself and instituting more and more extreme forms of government.
It's interesting that you're using the French Revolution as an example. I mean, most people think about the Iranian Revolution and the way the Ayatollahs have crushed protest movements. But, you know, you really think heads will roll? Who's going to respond to that? Reza?
No, I mean, I appreciate the thought, but I don't see that actually happening. I don't see
there been any economic changes, any improvements, anything tangible?
Well, there have been drastic economic changes for the worse. Inflation has skyrocketed in Egypt. International investment has, gone down from the billions of dollars in 2010 to about $500 million.
No tourism.
There's no tourism. No, but this is expected. I mean, this is not the idea that we're talking about the Egyptian revolution as though it's something that's over is kind of silly. And going back to the previous caller's point, it took 200 years for us to get prayer out of schools. Egypt has had 1 year of democracy. So, maybe we ought to give it a little bit of more time before we call it a failure.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what has changed as a result of all these uprisings?
Oh, I think an enormous amount has changed. And I think that it's really easy for people who are caught up in the day-to-day politics of it to miss just how much has really changed. But, I mean, if you go to a place like Libya or Tunisia, which a year and a half ago were some of the most repressive places on earth, you've got hundreds of newspapers, political parties, new constitutions, and this palpable air of newfound freedom across these countries. In Egypt, you've had parliamentary elections. You're on the way to presidential elections. The revolutionaries aren't getting everything they wanted, but there was never any chance of that. What there is some really profound changes that have taken place, I think mostly for the good. And one of those is this generational change of people who are simply not going to tolerate the old ways. They're not going to shut up because their government tells them to. On the flip side of it, though, you really do have, the violence and, what we're seeing in Syria right now, especially, is really, it's extraordinarily sobering. I would put Yemen into that category and Bahrain, where it's just the sense that a year ago you had this sense that, this is unstoppable and that the revolution couldn't lose. And now, you've got some examples of things turning really, really nasty and ugly. So I'm less worried about even Egypt over the long term. I think it's going to make a transition to something which is recognizably democratic, even by the standards we've been discussing today.
Yeah.
But a place like Syria, you can just see the possibility of pulling an entire part of the region down into the abyss.
Yeah. You're against
nothing to do with Islam. Yeah. This has to do with all kinds of other things.
You've come out against military intervention, and yet it is agonizing to stand by and watch the slaughter. Why wouldn't it work? It seemed to have had some success in Libya, although you can argue that.
Totally, I think it's totally different from Libya. I was supportive of the Libya intervention. I thought there was an opportunity there to do a tremendous amount of good in a short time. I think we prevented a massacre. I think that we managed to help a pretty well-organized opposition defeat really one of the worst dictators in the region. And I'm very hopeful for Libya. But in Syria, it's just entirely different. The opposition is much less organized, much weaker, and the regional context is entirely different. And basically, to put it down, as simply as possible, there's no intervention that we can do, plausibly do, which would make enough of a difference to win in a military confrontation between the rebels and the state, which is why I think efforts have to focus instead on diplomatic pressure, economic sanctions, international justice, and trying to push towards a political transition. I think that I understand that people want to help, but I don't think that military intervention or arming the opposition would actually help. That's the big difference.
I don't know if either of you heard the news report just before we went on the air, but apparently some emails have surfaced indicating that Iran is really calling the shots in Syria and guiding the Assad government on how to handle the protest movement. That's a disturbing idea, Reza.
Well, I would want to wait a week or two and see if those emails stand up to scrutiny. I'm not convinced of their authenticity just yet.
Yeah, and just regardless, calling the shots is an exaggeration. But I don't think anybody, and I don't think Mark would disagree with me, that Iran has been deeply influential in providing not just advice, but actually material support to Assad to crush the opposition in Syria. Iran has everything to lose in the demise of the Assad regime. It would like to do whatever it can to make sure that Assad remains in power, and certainly it has been helping Assad militarily, but calling the shots is going too far.
So what about people power? It has its limits. Is nonviolence really a force more powerful?
Well, nonviolence is a tactic, and it's only good insofar as it works. To say that, for instance, in Libya they should have used nonviolence to bring down Gaddafi is kind of ridiculous, because you are not dealing with a sane individual with whom a tactic nonviolence would have any effect. So,
yeah.
I am definitely a proponent of nonviolent means, but only insofar as they actually work. In a situation like we're seeing in Syria, where nonviolence is simply not working as a strategy for change, I cannot by any means condemn the Syrian opposition for simply saying enough and we're going to start fighting back.
I want to thank you both. It's been a great hour. It's really been a treat to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us on your last show. Great honor.
You'll find links to Reza Aslan and Mark Lynch when you visit our website at hereonearth.org. And also, I want to send you to the blog, Inside Islam blog, where you'll find posts on the importance of accountability in Islam, the many names of God, and Islam and democracy. And don't forget about that conference coming up on the 13th and 14th.